Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
You still want the kids to eat it. You can't just force everything healthy to them and expect them to change overnight.
That's Bob Atkins, cook at the Monroe County United Ministries, where he cooks three meals for 80 kids every day. He says the kids aren't shy about telling him what they like and what they don't. From Harvest Public Media, a report about how both sides of the food debate are aiming their message at the other side. Then in the kitchen today, two traditional Christmas Eve dishes. Chef Daniel Orr makes oyster stew, and then we get a tamale-making tutorial from the folks of Mother Hubbard's Cupboard. Stay with us. Mia Partlow is here, as always. Today, three stories from this week in food news.
Bad news for the Farm Bill. House Speaker John Boehner says it will not be included in his year-end budget deal. According to Politico, Boehner believes adding a Farm Bill is too cumbersome at this stage, and it's better left for the new Congress. If August 2013 becomes the new deadline for a five-year bill, questions arise about the fate of direct payments owed to farmers in October. Senate Agriculture Committee Chairwoman Debbie Stabenow is still hoping for a Christmas miracle. She spoke on the Senate floor Wednesday, saying there's no excuse to not pass a five-year farm bill now. Quebec provincial police have arrested three men believed to be behind the largest maple syrup heist in Canadian history. Authorities say thieves absconded with $18 million in syrup between August 2011 and July 2012. Authorities seized 1,000 barrels of syrup from the New Brunswick-based SK Export Inc., but 30% of the stolen syrup remains unaccounted for. Law enforcement officials fear it may have already been sold in the United States. The stolen syrup was pilfered from the Strategic Maple Syrup Reserve kept by the Federation of Quebec Maple Syrup Producers. And world food prices are continuing to remain high, a trend that impacts the nearly 1 billion worldwide that go hungry. Food prices stabilized in July, according to the World Food Bank, but they still remain 7% higher than they were a year ago. Several factors could explain the continuing hike. Bad weather, including the drought that impacted the United States grain production this year, and countries moving towards a more meat-heavy and therefore grain-heavy diet. Speculation may also be at play. Financial traders bet on agricultural futures like other commodities, and deregulation has allowed for an increased role for trading. Get news updates like this all week long by liking us on Facebook and following us on Twitter. Just search for Earth Eats.
And read more about these stories at eartheats.org. Our news team and Mia Partlow all taking a break the next couple weeks, so we'll hear from you again in January.
That's right. See you in the new year.
Debate surrounding what we eat and how it's made is nothing new. But in this year of outcry over pink slime, criticism regarding gestation crates, and questions about the value of organic food, the various sides are reaching out in new ways and new places, and sometimes to each other. As Sandhya Dirks reports for Harvest Public Media, middle ground is still proving hard to find.
It's a steamy late summer day on Paul Willis's hog farm in Thornton, Iowa. There's only the suggestion of a breeze shaking the tree leaves, and hogs are milling around in an open pen, their large wet noses rooting for food. Willis is the founder of the Nyman Ranch Pork Company, and today he's giving a tour to a special visitor, the president of the Humane Society of the United States, Wayne Pacelli. Pacelli is on the front lines of the Great Crate Debate, what hog producers call gestation crates, and the Humane Society calls confinement crates on factory farms. As part of a new tactic, Pacelli is taking his message directly to farm country. Willis shows Pacelli how he does things.
We can walk on down.
Did you ever do confinement, Paul?
No, never really. I went in one of those buildings once, an early one, and I said, if I have to This is a way to raise pigs. I'm not doing it.
By releasing videos depicting stomach-turning scenes from confinement operations, Pacelli and the Humane Society have been successful in getting fast food restaurants like McDonald's and food providers like Sysco to promise not to carry pork produced in confinement farms. Now, Pacelli is working to bring more farmers on board.
And with all of these retailers saying that they don't want any part of that in the future, it's inevitable. It's now just a question of, are we going to have an orderly transition, or are we going to continue to have, a fight about it?
We will be more than happy to sit down and discuss food and food production with any individual or any person that recognizes the right and the need for all forms of production agriculture to exist.
That's Hugh Whaley, the head of the U.S. Farmers and Ranchers Alliance, or USFRA. Whaley says they will only talk with groups that promise to keep all farming practices on the table. It's a nice way of saying the food wars are still very much on. USFRA is a coalition of farmers and ag groups who came together 2 years ago.
By and large, we were not being asked to enter and engage in the conversation about food. So we decided to take matters in our own hands and collectively come together.
Whaley says food producers have been misrepresented, and the food industry is partially to blame. For too long, the knee-jerk reaction of those in agriculture and agribusiness was to close ranks. Whaley says that's got to stop. Journalist Michael Pollan was one of the first to raise questions about food production, and he says that he agrees with Whaley.
I mean, basically, they feel that shutting up has not served them well, and that letting people like me and these humane activists tell their story is worse than, you know, letting, you know, them giving interviews and telling their own story.
That's why USFRA is hosting events they call food dialogues, not in the heartland, but on the coasts, like Los Angeles and most recently New York. And USFRA is using other techniques, like training farmers to talk with the media. One of those farmers is Stacy Pellet.
But we just did pull up in time for you to see you down.
Pellet greets her uncle-in-law. It's harvest time on their 6,000-acre farm just outside of Atlantic, Iowa. USFRA sent Pellet to San Francisco to learn how to talk to the media and how to talk to people who think of big farms as a bad thing.
So I'm well-educated in talking with people, but what they really taught me was how to understand where they are coming from and the position that they, or the viewpoint that they have, and to be able to find something that's relatable to where I'm coming from so that we can meet on common ground.
As Pellet drives around her family's farm, she explains her biggest tool is to talk from personal experience as a mother and a farmer. She says people who criticize farmers often don't understand what it means to make food.
You know, people sometimes think of it as a corporate environment, or if you get large, you are no longer a family farm, but we are a family farm, whether we farm 10 acres or 10,000 acres.
Back at Paul Willis's farm, he says agribusiness has changed even how farmers think about farming.
A lot of these skills are passed from one generation to the next. I've actually had agriculture classes of farm kids that have come out. We had a group of about 20, and none of these kids, all grown up a farm, had ever seen a pig outdoors before.
So up for grabs is how future generations will farm and what future eaters will demand from their food. I'm Sandhya Dirks, reporting for Harvest Public Media.
Read and listen to more stories from the reporting team at Harvest Public Media on their website, harvestpublicmedia.org. Earlier this year, First Lady Michelle Obama announced changes to the National School Lunch Program that included more variety of fruits and vegetables, less high-fat food, and a limit on the amount of meat and grains meals can contain. But many school administrators have protested, saying the new regime leaves children hungry and places undue burden on local school districts. Well, last week, the USDA pulled back on some of those new standards, allowing more flexibility regarding grains and meat.
A three-door freezer. This box of corn dogs has been here since I got here. It's just a monument.
I'm in the kitchen of the Monroe County United Ministries, a daycare facility, also called Macum. The daycare's cook, Bob Adkins, is giving me a tour of the three-door freezer. There are bags of apples and bananas, huge vats of fat-free yogurt, and salad that's already been chopped because Adkins doesn't have the time or the manpower to do it himself. He doesn't have to abide by the school lunch standards, but he does feel a responsibility to serve healthy meals to the kids.
Pork chops from the food bank, local pork chops they get every now and then. You know, it's not, we can't subsist entirely on food bank, but we'll take what we can get at 16 cents a pound across the board. Frozen.
Peas, and, is that Brussels sprouts?
Uh-huh. We've actually had pretty good luck with Brussels sprouts. The preferred preparation was boiling before, and that just turned into mush, and they get all cabbagey and sulfury tasting. But if you roast them from a frozen state, they're not so bad.
Longtime Earth Eats listeners will recognize Bob Adkins as the former chef de cuisine at Farm Bloomington. He's now splitting his culinary life between being the chef at Bloomington restaurant The Rail and being the cook at Macum. I met up with him sometime between breakfast and morning snack, right before he starts prepping for lunch, with his assistant, Derek Mackey. In addition to their cooking duties, they also set the chairs, sanitize the tables, and wash all the dishes.
This is not a glamorous chef job, and I will say, you know, it was a lot of pride-swallowing, kind of, to become a lunch man, a lunch lady, or what have you.
But this is more than simply a pay-the-bills job for Adkins. He's serious about the food he serves to the kids, making sure it's as nutritious and delicious as the circumstances and his budget line will allow. He's gotten creative with his ingredients list, and the kids are surprisingly receptive.
Sriracha makes it into quite a few things, curry powders or coconut milks, things like that. They really do like baked cod. You put a little lemon pepper salt on there and some extra virgin olive oil.
Adkins might not ever serve those ancient corn dogs in the freezer, but he's not completely forsaking traditional cafeteria fare. Chicken nuggets, for instance, he serves those maybe once every 6 weeks. The rest of the time, he uses his chef chops to make some good stuff.
We do pizza. I'll make pizza, but I'll use a whole grain pizza dough, make the dough in-house, real cheese sauce that I made here. And so it relies a lot on somebody that understands how food kind of works and how the kids are going to work with it, too.
Serving healthy food that's palatable to kids starts with purchasing the best possible ingredients that fit into his shoestring budget. Then he uses cooking techniques similar to those he employs in a professional kitchen.
You know, a lot I get from a large purveyor, but also once a week I go to the food bank. And the food bank is usually a food grab for giant agencies that are trying to feed hundreds, if not thousands, of people. Whereas really 80 kids a day, I can get away with two or three jars of something. And so I can get really nice organic products from there and utilize it in a more creative way. Also then in the preparation of the dishes, utilizing spices and techniques to impart flavor without coming over the top, without having to do fancy presentations. That's what people pay for in restaurants. Here, this is about the nutrition, getting to the food to the kids, and also getting them to eat it. So if you can caramelize something or you can add that little bit of addictive spice to something that you know everybody loves anyways, children, kids are no different. They're just little people.
So caramelized, what are the other things that you found that just across the board the kids like?
Honey does really well. It's not sugar, it's not corn syrup, and small amounts of that goes a long way. I was talking about Brussels sprouts before a minute ago. A little bit of honey on roasted Brussels sprouts really just changes that whole idea of what it tastes to them.
Do you get feedback from the kids about the taste, about what you're cooking?
The beauty of kids is their honesty, and they are so honest. You know, some days I'll walk by, we do seconds, about 10, 15 minutes after they've sat down, and if we have seconds and they want them, we'll go around and ask. And, you know, sometimes they'll look up at me and they'll say, "Bob, I don't like this." And I can't say much. I really can't. I appreciate the honesty. I really wish more people were honest in that kind of way.
One of the criticisms of the new school lunch standards is that kids are going to eat what they want to eat, and they're going to throw away the stuff that they don't like. So forcing them to eat healthy wastes a whole lot of food and leaves the kids hungry for the second half of their day. As someone who's cooking for a whole slew of kids, how would you respond to that?
Oh, my gosh. That's where I struggle to find a balance.
just giving it a little bit of time, watching how much food gets thrown away. If something's not eaten after 5 or 6 times, you know, this is what they talk about in the training, you have to give it to them at least 5 times before they even will start to, you know, see if they like it because it's so unfamiliar. So I think you just continue to try different approaches. A lot of times it seems as though these standards are put in place by someone who's never actually cooked in a cafeteria or worked with the foods in a cafeteria. And it sounds and looks great on paper, but when it comes to actually executing them, whole grain anything is more expensive. Fresh fruits, fresh vegetables, 2 to 4 to 5 times more expensive than buying a can. And then within cooking with that, like I said, to add variety, there's only so many options that, one, the children will eat, and two, that can be executed with such a small staff. If the government is going to throw a lot of money into putting these standards into place and then give them to inexperienced cooks who haven't worked with some of these ingredients, it's going to fall flat on its face.
Read more about Bob Atkins and school food on our website. Let us know what you think about how children are being fed by writing a comment at eartheats.org. Coming up, Christmas Eve tamale.
Everything is by sound. I'm listening for things to tell me, you know, when to turn down heat, when the masa's ready. There's just all the senses are involved.
Vicky Thrasher has been making this traditional Mexican dish for the holidays ever since she was a girl. Coming up, she tells us what to listen for. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, fresh, local, organic food with delis at all 3 locations and a garden center on East 3rd Street, bloomingfoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels at the corner of Buick Cadillac Boulevard and Auto Mall Road, 1 block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness, massage and yoga. More at touchstonewellness.com. And Designscape Horticultural Services, designing sustainable growth for a changing environment for over 25 years, building living soil for edibles and ornamentals with enhanced compost tea, and boosting plant health by enriching soil biology. 812-988-8900 or designhort.com. Welcome back to Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan. Last week, we cooked a duck over an open fire, a typical Christmas dish for many. Today, we're looking at a Mexican food tradition, the Christmas Eve tamale. These little packages contain corn-based masa and various fillings, from savory to sweet, meat or vegetarian, all wrapped in a corn husk. It's a time-consuming, labor-intensive process, so multiple sets of hands are definitely a necessity. Kate Young is the nutrition education coordinator at Mother Hubbard's Cupboard.
I am a tamale enthusiast. I have been since I was a child, and I like to cook. I like to cook everything from scratch, but I cannot make these. And so hopefully after today, I will be able to make tamales, thanks to Vicky.
Today, Young is playing sous chef for Vicky Thrasher, a volunteer at Mother Hubbard's, who's known for her tamale making. They're preparing the materials for Mother Hubbard's Make Your Own Tamale workshop. First order of business is to mix the masa. It has to have good flavor, of course, but the consistency is just as important. Can't be too sticky or too gritty. Thrasher uses all her senses to test the masa.
A lot of Mexican cooking has a lot to do with sound as well. So like when I'm slapping the masa back down, I'm actually listening for a sound.
that.
Is that a good sound? It was very.
Good
it was a thwack.
Yeah, because you don't want it runny, and you don't want it to be like sticking to your finger. So you want it to just come off nice and clean, but still have like body to it. Yeah, I don't know if you can hear that or not, but I could hear it. And I know what I'm listening for, and there's, I don't know, and I know what I'm feeling.
Tamales are actually a New Year's tradition in Thrasher's family. She first made them when she was in the fifth grade under the supervision of her aunt.
I do remember we didn't have a mixer then. We were doing it by hand. And she came in and checked on us, and I told her, yep, we mixed it here. And she said, she started laughing at me and said, you're not done. That's not mixed. And then you learn mixing it by hand when you're like 40, 50 minutes into it. And she comes back down and says, maybe 5 more minutes, you know.
Thank God for the countertop mixer,
yes.
Right?
Yes. Okay, so before we actually start assembling, we have to get the pot ready. And our pot here is just a regular stock pot, right?
Yeah, it's a tall stock pot. It's more than 12 quarts. You can make your own tamale steamer with equipment that you would probably already have in your kitchen. So a stock pot, a vegetable steamer, one of those fold-out baskets.
Pennies.
Pennies? Literally?
Pennies.
You just toss 2 pennies in the bottom. Why? Mm-hmm.
Because that's going to tell me when the water is boiling. Everything is by sound. I'm listening for things to tell me, you know, when to turn down heat, when the masa's ready. There's just all the senses are involved.
And I'm going to put some water in this now.
That's cool. Not much water. But how many inches is that? Like 2 inches of water?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the pennies are going to start jumping. Is that what you're listening for?
The pennies will jump. The pennies will jump, and then I'll turn the heat down.
So you filled the water just to the steamer, and now you're putting a layer of the husks down? Mm-hmm.
A layer of husks to help keep the steam. We want to make it steam, and we want to keep the moisture in. Otherwise, it'll dry out our tamales.
Young and Thrasher work in tandem to assemble the tamales. They're making 2 kinds today, chicken and green chiles, and one for the vegetarians, queso fresco and chile and corn relish. They place the husks on the palms of their hands to start, from wrist to fingertips.
There's a certain direction to husks. There's a smooth side and there's a rough side. I'm using the smooth side. You can hear the rough side is definitely has ridges. You don't want to put the masa on that because it'll stick to it. You want it to be able to slide out when it's done.
And it's just a thin layer that you're doing.
Mm-hmm. Just the palm of my hand, and I feel like, you know, there's good weight to it. I don't go too far down. I don't go down my wrist.
Yeah, so you're leaving out, what is that?
Husk? 3 or 4 inches down on the bottom, because when I fold it up, that's going to be the lip that goes up and keeps it balanced. So then I wrap it. And then I'll set it down and I'll start lining my pan up.
And you're standing it up, sort of like a tamale soldier in the pot.
Yeah.
Why do they need to be standing up?
They're going to rise. And mine, traditionally, because of the way I like them, they're going to go past the husk. That's okay. That's my little treats when I get done with them, because I can, as I pull them out, I can taste them and see.
Yeah, they're good.
Grab a bite.
A classic Mexican Christmas Eve feast would probably also include oyster stew. The tradition is said to have come to the States with Irish immigrants. Their Catholic faith prohibited them from eating meat the day before a religious celebration, so fish stew was their alternative. Same goes for Italian feasts. Chef Daniel Orr is in the kitchen, ready to throw together an oyster stew.
What we're going to start with are the leeks. Now, if you aren't familiar with leeks, it's in the member of the allium family, which is the onion family. And it looks like a big scallion. But there is something that you have to worry about, is that it can be very sandy. They're planted in very sandy soil. So what you want to do is just to kind of cut off the very end, the root end, but you still leave the base attached a little bit. That will hold the leek together. Then what we're going to do is make a long cut down the middle, but not all the way through, so we can kind of open it up. And you'll see all those different layers of the leek in there. What we're going to do is we're going to take this over to the sink, and then just with some high-pressured water, just rinse it out really well. Now, the outer leaves of the leek, the real dark green ones, they can tend to be a little bit tougher. So just set these aside and use those in your vegetable stock or your chicken stock, or if you want to make a potato leek soup. But we want the real tender, light green and white part of the leek for this stew. Okay, I'm just going to cut it in about a quarter inch dice. Okay, you do eat with your eyes, and you always want to have some appealing colors. You know, you don't want to have a dish that's white on white on white, which this kind of would be with the oysters and the cream and the celery. So you want a little bit of that green from the leek on the top there. Okay, and now we're just going to wash this again, and then we're ready to go. Okay, next I've got my pan on the fire. I'm just going to chop up some garlic quickly. Okay, I'm going to add some butter to my pan. You really want to hear that sizzle, but you don't want the butter to really brown. Okay, I'm going to quickly add these leeks. And it's okay to have a little bit of that water go in there because that will prevent them from browning. Okay, we're going to add that finely minced celery. Now I want to have these veggies a little bit toothsome, and that will be a nice textural contrast to the oysters. All right, now we're just going to add our seasonings. One of my favorites, again, some lemon zest. And again, lemon zest adds that wonderful citrus flavor through its essential oils without adding a lot of acid. You really don't want, especially something real creamy, you don't want to have a lot of acid in it or it can curdle. Okay, I'm going to add a little bit of cayenne pepper for our heat, a little bit of the Kitchen Dior New Regime blend. I'm going to add a couple sprigs of thyme. And now what we're going to do is just add our half and half. Now, I said this was an easy recipe, but it's also a rich one. Once this comes to a boil, we add the oysters. We don't want to cook it much once we add the oysters, though they'll become tough. In the meantime, I've toasted some nice baguette bread, and I've pre-warmed our bowls. So once this is done, we're going to be able to go straight to the table, which is very important. All right, it's come to a full boil. I'm going to add the oysters with the liquor. The liquor is the juice that is from the oysters. Again, you don't want to oversalt your stew because you're going to be adding the oysters to it, and they tend to have a little bit of that saline flavor from the ocean. Now, the most important part of this dish is not to overcook your oysters. So you want to cook them until what I call they smile, okay? The little edges around the oyster are going to start to wrinkle up and smile at you. And we are there.
This recipe lives on our website along with a bunch of other great recipes. Persimmon pudding, lentil tarragon soup, a traditional eggnog recipe. Plan your Christmas menu with the help of eartheats.org. Thanks to everyone who helps make Earth Eats possible, including Bob Adkins, Ben Alford, Ayabon Binder, Sarah Gordon, Liz Leslie, Daniel Orr, Vicky Thrasher, Kate Young, and the entire team at Harvest Public Media. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, fresh, local, organic food with delis at all three locations and a garden center on East 3rd Street, bloomingfoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels at the corner of Buick Cadillac Boulevard and Auto Mall Road, one block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness Massage and Yoga, 812-337-3529 or 33RELAX. And Designscape Horticultural Services, designing sustainable growth for a changing environment for over 25 years, building living soil for edibles and ornamentals with enhanced compost tea, and boosting plant health by enriching soil biology. 812-988-8900 or designhort.com. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. Next week, it's our New Year's show with two traditional recipes for corned beef and black-eyed peas. Make sure you come back for that. Happy holidays from all of us here at Earth Eats. Thanks for listening. I'm Annie Corrigan.